Can you hear me, Kevin?
Yes, yes, I can.
Okay.
I'd like to welcome back Professor Paul Ehrlich as today's honored guest on Nature Bats Last. Paul is Bing Professor of Population Studies and Professor of Biological Sciences at Stanford University. He is the author of 30-plus books, many in collaboration with his wife, Anne, and numerous peer-reviewed science papers, the most recent of which we covered a few months ago on this show entitled Biological Annihilation via the Ongoing Sixth Mass Extinction Signaled by Vertebrate Population Losses and Decline. Today's show is a call-in show. For our US listeners, they can call, dial 888-744-888, or for international listeners, 001-60-556-25119. All of those numbers are on a post on the top of my Facebook wall if anyone wants to go and catch them. Today I'd like to discuss the book, The Annihilation of Nature, co-authored by Paul, his wife Anne, and Gerardo Ceballos. The book was published in 2015, and I really would like people to have a look at it and see the amazing illustrations of extinct species and fantastic photos. Welcome back, Paul.
Nice to be back. I'm feeling really good because I've been drinking a lot of wine from the Marlboro area. Some actually appeared by magic here a week or so ago. Great stuff.
Well, I'm trying to do my tiny little bit to prop up the failing New Zealand economy.
Well, you're laying me down in a political situation where it's very hard to stand up.
Hey, I thought we'd go through the preface to the book and then we'll just discuss it in general terms. How do you feel about that?
Anything you want to do. Cool. We should mention Jaws sometime, though, in the talk.
We will indeed. Humanity has unleashed a massive and escalating assault on all living things on this planet. The purpose of this book is to shine a spotlight on the onslaught, focusing on losses of the animals that are most familiar to people, birds and mammals. The root of this destruction runs deep through time. Human hunting and other activities were responsible for pushing populations of animals to extinction long before the agricultural revolution, which began about 10,000 years ago. Today, however, our collective assault on animals, plants and microbes has reached such a horrendous level that any alarm call we might sound will be too faint to match the tragedy that is unfolding. The alarm must be amplified, listen to our stories, learn what's happening, and demand change. Fantastic intro for the book, Paul. Thank you.
Thank you for reading it. It's heartfelt, believe me. As a matter of fact, I think it's heartfelt from the point of view of anybody who's been interested in nature, out in nature, and watching what's going on. There wasn't anybody else around. There were no human beings the last time we got into an episode like this was even before I was born. It was 66 million years ago, roughly, when an asteroid hit the planet and we lost all of the dinosaurs except for the birds. So it's a brand new thing for humanity to be facing the extinction of its only living companions that we know about in the universe and on whom our civilization and lives absolutely depends. So we're busily cutting off the limb we're sitting on.
It's as if we're playing the ultimate game of Jenga. We keep removing species from the fabric and the biosphere, the whole fabric of the biosphere. And we remove 150 to 200 is the official UN statistics. And I note in one passage in the book, in the chapter called The Legacy, I'll just quote a small section of it. As surprising as it may seem, we are far from having even a rough grasp of the total number of species, plants, animals, and microorganisms that populate our planet. Even though roughly 1.8 million species have been named and described so far, recent estimates of the total number of species on Earth have ranged from a few million to more than 100 million species. I think what that paragraph shows is how little we know about what we're doing and how dangerous it is that we are attacking it in such a way. You know, there's a strong chance that there are keystone species in this biosphere that we still haven't identified.
And we're wiping a lot of them out. And of course, the biggest problem at the moment is not the loss of the entire species, but the loss of populations that precedes the end of the species. Example I like to give, which I may even given to you before, is that if we lost all the honeybees in the Western Hemisphere, we'd still have the same number of species on the planet. But in North America, we'd suffer an economic loss of something like $20 billion and have a much poorer diet as a result. So we're wiping out things that are extraordinarily valuable to us. And as you point out, we don't really understand the diversity as well as we'd like to. On the other hand, you don't have to have named and counted the number of grains of sand on a beach to know if the beach is eroding away. And what we do know is our extraordinarily valuable resource, living resources are eroding away at a horrendous rate. I don't know whether you see this in New Zealand, because I've not done the right things in New Zealand. But when I was a kid, if you drove around the eastern United States on a summer evening, you often had to stop your car to clean dead moths off of your windshield or sort moths and butterflies out of the radiator of your car. All gone. And recent data show that insects in Europe are going down the drain. And of course, we don't even understand the main ecological roles played by most of the million or so species of insects that we've already described. We do know some of them, particularly the butterflies that supply us with incredible beauty. It's sometimes called a cultural ecosystem service, but the insects are much more important to us than that. What can I say? It's a dismal picture. And in the United States, we have a government that's trying to make it worse as fast as it can.
Yeah, it's virtually a suicide wish. But I think when you remember that evangelical Christians play such a primary role in the political process in the United States, and they believe in the rapture, you can join the dots and wonder if it's not in some kind of macabre way a plan. Yeah.
A biological rapture. It's not a good way to commit suicide for Homo sapiens to end our civilization, but that's what we're busy doing. And, you know, it's tightly tied to the disruption of the climate. It's tightly tied to the spread of toxic substances all over the planet. One of the things that one of my colleagues recently pointed out to me, and we're actually writing a short paper on it probably, is that we have, in the whole human predicament, finally come across a negative feedback mechanism. Now, a negative feedback is a situation where if you have a thermostat, for example, that's normally a negative feedback system. If you turn the thermostat to a certain temperature, if the temperature is below that, more heat will be added. If the temperature is above that, more air conditioning will be added, and the temperature is kept stable. So negative feedbacks tend to make our environment steadier. Positive feedbacks is mostly what we have. That is, if you build a thermostat so that you set the temperature at a certain point and it was too cold, you would add heat. But the more heat you added, the more that would raise the set point. So you kept adding heat until you got the maximum amount of heat. Most of the feedbacks we know in nature that we have triggered today are positive feedbacks. That is, when you add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, the climate warms. That tends to melt the ice in the Arctic. The ice no longer reflects away as much of the sun's heat as it used to. The heat is absorbed by the now bare ocean, and it gets hotter still, which melts more ice, which produces more bare ice ocean, which absorbs more heat, and it gets even hotter than that, and you get a positive feedback that runs away. We finally found a negative feedback that human beings are contributing, and that is there's every sign that toxic chemicals are reducing the human sperm count and doing it seriously. So the more toxic chemicals you add, it's likely the fewer people there will be, the fewer people there will be, the fewer toxic chemicals, and we may actually turn it around and solve the population problem by male sterility. You remember the old women's lib line, a woman without a man is like a fish without a bicycle.
I remember it well. I think it might have even been said to me on occasion by women. Well, you mentioned in the beginning of that about the loss of insects, and in the book there's a section talking about aerial plankton, and that really surprised me because, you know, as a sailor I've had a lot of involvement, and a diver I've had a lot of involvement with the ocean, and I've been engaged with the plankton. And I never thought about the fact that our flying insect population fitted that category as well. And, you know, we've lost something like 40 or 50% of the ocean plankton in the last few decades. And we've absolutely decimated the airborne plankton. And these are fundamental keystone members of the biosphere. So these are Jenga blocks that really hold the whole thing together. And we're just bathing the planet in herbicides and pesticides and ionizing radiation, which these species are really susceptible to because of the fact that they have such short life cycles and breed so quickly. Can you give that a little bit of consideration?
Well, when you get rid of the insects, of course, you're at the same time getting rid of most of the birds, because the birds are really important to the insects are important food sources for the birds, for the bats. More importantly, they're critical pollinators of our crops, and the crops that are insect pollinated are extraordinarily important parts of the having a high nutrition diet. Insects are also the main controls on other insects that eat our crops. That is, the natural predators that control crop pests. And the natural predators have smaller populations than the pests. For one thing, that's why we call the pests pests. For another, they're one step further up the food chain. And as those of you probably learned in high school, at each level in the food chain, you lose quantity so that there are more weight of plants than there are plant eaters. There's more weight of plant eaters than there are insect eaters. more weight of insects eating plants than there are of plants, and more weight of insects eating insects than of the plant-eating insects. So the smaller the population, the more susceptible they are to the poisons. And so you start poisoning the food chain from the top down, and you get rid of the predators that are controlling your crop pests before you get rid of the crop pests. And they're particularly hard to get rid of because they have huge populations and a lot of genetic variability and are much readier to become resistant to pesticides than predatory insects. That may have sound complicated, but the basic thing is when you try and control insects with poisons, the general trend is to get rid of the useful insects, that is the ones that protect our crops, and encourage the enemies which eat our crops.
I get it totally, but the big pharma and big ag don't get it at all for some particular reason.
Well, one of the reasons is that they're propagandized by the chemical companies. One of the big mistakes we made as human beings was to create limited liability corporations that, as has been analyzed, have all the characteristics of psychopaths. They have no empathy. They don't think about the future. They care about nothing but the bottom line. If we ever get through the collapse and form a new society, we've got to think, as Joel Bacon has pointed out many times, on how to design an economic system that isn't totally for growth, the bottom line, and the hell with what happens to our life support systems or our general well-being. It's a big challenge. I don't think we'll solve it today. Although a little more Marlboro wine, I might be able to.
We'll work on that. What I think that leads to is the whole story about the economic system is predated on infinite growth on a finite planet. And as Edward Abbey was famously quoted as saying, infinite growth is the ideology of the cancer cell.
Yeah, that's one of the great quotes that I've used a lot. Another one came from a famous economist whose name skips my mind at the moment, but it'll come back to me, who said anybody who believes in perpetual growth on a finite planet is either a madman or an economist. And that was a very distinguished economist.
It's so simple and yet so obvious, and yet it is ignored. And I can't believe how it can be ignored right across the spectrum. I had a conversation with the deputy leader of the Green Party in New Zealand last year or 18 months ago, and they were talking about positive growth.
Green growth is an oxymoron. And partly it's because they consider also growth in the number of people to be positive, which of course is insane, but there's this political correctness that the idea that there can be too many people at one time on the planet is considered terrible or racist or something like that. But of course, what's really racist is to try and maximize the size of the population, because you're denying people of all ethnicities, attitudes, and so on in the future the ability to exist. In other words, if you want to maximize the number of people, you want to get a sustainable population. Maybe today it would be 500 million or 1 billion people if you could gradually move to that and keep it there for maybe several million years instead of having the whole thing collapse around the end of this century or before. But most people don't learn enough. You know, the average politician has to take off his or her shoes to count up to 20. And in the U.S., the average politician doesn't know how to take off or put on their shoes. They need help.
That's what we've been reduced to. And what I see happening around me is that there's a big discussion about plastic bags. We have to limit the number of plastic bags going into the ocean. And there's this huge discussion about plastic straws. So everyone's engaged on this issue of plastic straws. No one talks about the fact that we're bathing the planet in ionizing radiation from the leak at the triple meltdown at Fukushima Daiichi. No one goes there because there's no way for us to even deal with that. And then
what we're doing is emptying the ashtray, trying to empty the ashtrays on the arms of the deck chairs on the Titanic. In other words, obviously, we should quit making plastic almost entirely. We're turning the oceans into plastic. There's probably by now, but certainly soon, more weight of plastic in the oceans than there are fishes. The plastic gets ground into tiny micro particles, which are so small they can cross your blood-brain barrier. They collect on their surface persistent organic pollutants, which are poisons, and they enter the marine food chains, are eaten by plankton, and then the plankton by fish, and then guess who eats the fish? And we're loading ourselves with these tiny poisonous plastic droplets, and nobody's thinking of doing, you know, getting rid of plastic soda straws is just a tiniest thought in the right direction. There's other things being done, but unless we can find some way to cheaply and easily totally degrade plastics, we are in deep trouble from that alone. But remember, other poisons are now spread from pole to pole. And every time you do a test, for instance, if you test the IQ of children who live upwind from the lead smelter and downwind from the lead smelter, the ones upwind who are not exposed to the same lead fumes have higher IQs than the ones downstream. Same thing happens if you check the kids born upwind of the fields that are being sprayed with insecticides versus downwind. The upwind kids who don't get the pesticides are smarter. And there are many people who feel that we are dumbing down Homo sapiens, that actually humanity is becoming stupider. I hadn't seen any really solid empirical evidence of that until the 2016 Republican presidential debates. That was certainly solid evidence that we're getting dumber.
And I think that is also the role of the corporate media. It's not to inform, it's to control.
Absolutely. They're interested only in the bottom line. I can recommend to you, if you want to have an excuse for drinking a lot more Marlboro Sauvignon Blanc, a book by a woman named Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R, called Dark Money. It's Jane Mayer, Dark Money. It's a long book which will show you how the ultra-rich, getting even richer in the United States, are quite happy to destroy the world to increase their own wealth, even though they already, many of them, have billions of dollars. It's a sickening read.
I think that's the pathological insanity that we bear witness to at this stage of extreme cowboy capitalism. You know, in my lifetime, in your lifetime, we've seen such extraordinary changes, not just in the biosphere, but in the economic system. There was a time when conservatives were, there was a positive aspect to conservatism. You know, they were conservative about how they did things. And now what you see at the extremes of capitalism is psychopathy and sociopathy, where they can see, you know, this article's been published about billionaires talking about knowing they're all going to end up on the end of a pitchfork. Yeah. They can see where this is all going, but because of their psychopathy and sociopathy, they don't see a reason to change it.
Most people don't remember that in the U.S., some of the best and earliest environmental laws in the world were introduced by Richard Nixon in a Republican administration. Things have changed very dramatically, and there's no sign of them changing back. Everybody over here, of course, who doesn't have to take off their shoes to count up to 20 is totally depressed by the political situation. Our democracy is crumbling, and nobody's doing anything about it, really. It's an extraordinary situation. I didn't think I'd live long enough to see it. When I was younger, I thought we were moving in the right direction in the 60s and 70s when we began to pay attention to the environment and pay attention to the rights of women and the rights of minorities and so on. But Donald Trump and his kakistocracy has turned the whole thing around. By the way, do people in New Zealand know about Donald Trump if they recognize his name?
He would be the laughing stock. But, you know, that's a very dangerous thing. For someone in such an important role to be ridiculed and mocked to the level he is shows you how dire the situation is.
It certainly does, but he's being... What isn't broadcast is the extreme effectiveness he's having in destroying people's rights, in destroying the democratic system, in winning the war on the environment. He's winning the war on women. So, he's a buffoon. He's stupid and ugly, and he's a loser, but he's being very effective at helping his allies and followers destroy our country and quite likely the world.
On April the 3rd, Trump signed the Joint House Resolution number 29, rescinding the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's ban on killing native carnivores like bears and wolves when they have their cubs. He's allowed people to go out and slaughter these animals just after they've reproduced. He's made a conscious effort to make that possible for recreational hunters.
Yeah, he's a huge enemy of biodiversity. He hasn't got a clue. He doesn't realize that Trump Tower will fall when biodiversity gets low enough. He just doesn't get it. The point is, part of the blame is people like me. We have not managed to educate the American public on how the world works. He hasn't got the slightest clue what's important to the world. I doubt if he knows. Most Americans don't know where their food comes from beyond the supermarket. They have no idea the impact of climate disruption on food supplies, on energy and food supplies, on the issues of transport and so on, which are so tightly tied to food supplies. I think that's probably where the rubber's going to meet the road the first time, not with sea level rise, but with the impacts of climate disruption on agriculture and fisheries.
I think that's already happening now. You know, we see two things happening as we warm the climate, is that a whole lot of those big crops in the central continents, like wheat, all the wheat and the grains, they're already having major problems with quantities. And then, of course, as the level of CO2 goes up in the atmosphere, the nutritional value of these foods decreases.
That's right.
You know, it's the perfect storm.
Yeah, no, it's nutty. And, of course, from our discussion of Jaws, we know not only is the nutritional value of much of the food going to human beings reducing, but the toughness of them, the need for children to chew and for children to nurse, not drink from bottles and so on, is further degrading our human well-being while we wait for the crash that's going to be inevitable under the Trumpian kinds of policies and so on. We named ourselves Homo sapiens, the wise man, but I don't think the sapiens has been carried out very well.
I would love to ask all the other species what they think about the hairless ape naming themselves Sapien. We must be ridiculed, as well as hated. We must be ridiculed by all the other species for the hubris and arrogance that's shown by us.
Well, hubris is a main characteristic of our species, unhappily. I personally would rather see the world run by bonobos, you know, pygmy chimpanzees, rather than Trumps. The bonobos are wonderful animals. If you've never, there's wonderful pictures of them in a book by Frantz De Waal. But the main thing to remember about bonobos, which is different from human beings, is bonobos have never settled down to practice agriculture, never become, therefore, able to develop an industrial civilization and make nuclear weapons. Bonobos are absolutely without nuclear weapons. The way they solve their disputes is the way I would prefer us to do it. It's by genital rubbing. And I think if we could substitute genital rubbing for nuclear weapons, everybody would be happier.
Well, in a way, it is another form of masturbation, isn't it? The nuclear weapons.
Indeed.
Look at how big
mine is bigger than yours. What?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, we mentioned reticence previously, and talking about the spear, and I came across a wonderful quote from Joanna Macy just recently, and it reads, "Because of social taboos, despair at the state of our world and fear for our future are really acknowledged. The suppression of despair, like that of any deep recurring response, contributes to the numbing of the psyche." And the reason I'm bringing that quote up now is that on the weekend, last weekend, we had a working bee at the native tree nursery where I volunteer on Rakino Island. And we all went down, and all of the different people from the island came down, and we were repotting a whole lot of plants, standing around the table, all getting dirt under our fingernails. And one of the people there said, "Oh, how's your radio show going?" And I said, "Oh, great, thanks." So we talked about Jaws, that last time you and I talked, and the book that you wrote. And I said, "I'm going to be talking about Paul's book called The Annihilation of Nature." It's a really beautiful book. And the whole table just sort of stopped and turned to look at me and said, "How can that be?" You know, the book is absolutely beautiful because it goes into all these different species and it speaks really respectfully about them and the Armageddon that we're unfolding. But what the point I'm making there is that I said to them, no one wants to talk about the severity of the crisis. Everyone wants to walk away from how bad the situation is and not face it. And, you know, that is a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. If we don't get, I mean, one of our goals, as you know, with the book was to introduce people to the beauty and interest in other organisms, which is so often totally lost on kids that are raised in big cities and so on. You know, since we talked about jaws and the problem of shrinking jaws and not enough chewing, there's been a wonderful paper that I discovered, I think actually after you and I talked, about how people are now beginning to suffer an epidemic of nearsightedness, of myopia. And it comes from moving indoors. They're not sure whether it's because of the difference in the light or the failure of the eyes to focus frequently at the distance because everybody's looking close and looking at their cell phones and computers and so on. Doesn't really make much difference. We have changed our environment so much that we're wrecking ourselves and people don't get a chance. Kids now don't get out into national parks, don't get out to see what animals are like and how they behave and so on. I just wish, you know, that every teenager on the planet could have a tour of a wildlife park in Africa and see what we're losing there. I mean, would you really like to live in a world where there are no more elephants, lions, rhinos, hippos, giraffes, even if you've never seen one alive, even in a zoo? The very idea that we have that little bit of the Pleistocene left in Africa, to say nothing of the birds we all used to enjoy now in the United States that are disappearing. I mean, the aesthetic, we tried to indicate the aesthetic services we get from nature. I can't imagine a world without really interesting other organisms, but that's what we're working towards. By the way, good news, the publisher's going to reprint more copies of Annihilation of Nature, and there's going to be another PR effort to bring it to people's attention about 4 or 5 months from now.
Oh, wonderful.
Then I'll beg you to let me back on the show and we'll try and sell some in New Zealand. All the money that comes from these books goes to trying to save people on the planet.
So
all the money, by the way, is 25 cents often.
Hey, well, as part of this whole dichotomy, in one section on the book, there's a chapter about habitat loss and fragmentation and how that fragmentation is so critical to the loss of the continuity and survival of species.
Well,
What I'd like to talk about on that for a second is China's global infrastructure initiative, which is otherwise known as the Belt and Road Initiative. Have you heard about that?
Yeah. It's another plan to destroy the world.
You wouldn't believe it.
I don't know the details, but it's more roads, more shopping malls, more factories. It's just like when they talk about getting rid of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by building factories to extract it and pump it underground. They never tell you where the factories are going to be, how much they're going to cost, how much energy they're going to use, how much greenhouse gases they'll put into the atmosphere, creating them and running them, and so on. The world destroyers meet annually in Davos, Switzerland, to figure out how to destroy the world. I don't think the Chinese actually participate there. I think they do it on their own. But they're very effective, very efficient. Also, I have to say, much more than our government's concerned with the environment, because they've already screwed it up so badly, they're in deep trouble. The Chinese are busily buying land in Africa to grow food because they realize they can't satisfactorily feed their growing population on the land they've got in China. It's called agribusiness, and it's an international problem of Saudi Arabia, U.S., Britain, Saudi Arabia, China buying land in poor countries to feed themselves eventually.
I saw that 20 years ago when I worked on a development project in Mozambique, and it was already happening then. But since then, the invasion of Chinese money into Africa has been much, much more prolific. I'll just give you one more idea.
It isn't there for the benefit of for the Africans.
No way. It's currently planned, the Belt and Road Initiative. There are 7,000 separate infrastructure projects across 17 nations with a total price tag of $8 trillion US dollars.
That's more than I make in a year.
The pipeline. Yeah, right.
Well,
from your last book.
Yeah, right. It's nutty. I mean, there's no discussion on the shrinking the human enterprise project until we can persist on this planet with a decent life. It's just people are going to make money on it before they die, but they're going to die. And as you said something about pitchforks and pikes, it's going to be interesting for you youngsters to see when that hits. I'm kind of hoping to leave I don't think my head would look all that great on a pike anyway. We're working here to change the political system. We've got a candidate for the Democratic presidency in 2020 who's infinitely smarter than Trump, infinitely more articulate, comes from an industry unlike real estate development, which is one of the most corrupt and dangerous industries on the planet, and it's a woman. And too bad you New Zealanders can't vote for her. But if anybody in New Zealand heard her, she's the best known politician in the U.S. Her name is Stormy Daniels.
You're such a stirrer, Alec.
I mean, you got to get behind something you believe in, don't you?
Well, I think what you've got to do is I believe that gallows humor is a acceptable way for us to deal with this nightmare. Because if you can't laugh it off, it will just eat you up from the inside out.
I agree. How's the weather on the island now?
Deluge after deluge after deluge.
Winds and so on.
Yeah, stronger winds, much warmer than it should be for this time of the year. I'm sitting around in shorts and T-shirts, and it's winter now.
Yeah.
But I got 115 mils of rain in 24 hours yesterday. That's a pretty good deluge.
Well, we're getting the same thing in the eastern United States. We're having very heavy rains, and in the west, very heavy drought. And it's exactly what you'd expect with climate disruption. Of course, the warmer it gets, the more water the atmosphere will hold. And guess what? It has to come down every once in a while. And we've had very typical. I remember when I was in Australia in 1965, everybody was talking about the drought of a couple of years before. And I can remember one radio show announcing that that was a 1,000-year drought that would only occur every 1,000 years. The last one was in 1936. We had in Maryland a 100-year storm this year that was the second 100-year storm since the one 2 years ago. People just don't get it. I mean, the huge amount of evidence, the fires that are burning over much of the U.S. already as the summer fire season just begins. Nobody's saying is exactly what's expected with climate disruption. Anyway, at least you got Marlboro wines. If you stop with them, then I don't know what I'll do.
Well, all of that will be called into question as the climate changes radically. Yeah. Where because of the lack of molecules, we can't move a lot of that production from one crop up to different hemisphere, different latitudes, because the soil types don't travel with it.
Yeah, that's right. People keep thinking that the agriculture will just move around with temperature, not understanding that you've got to have certain temperature and precipitation patterns for thousands of years to get the soils you need in those things. But I'm sure you'll be able to grow grapes in Antarctica soon. That won't be any big problem.
Yeah, probably won't be any sapiens around to chew on them, but anyway.
But are we sure there's any sapiens around now?
Well, that's a very good point. That's exactly my point.
It's a version of the kind of line that Gandhi used when he was asked what he thought of Western civilization, and he said he thought it would be a good idea.
Well, after them being colonized by the British, they weren't bearing witness to much civilization.
Yeah. Well, I wish I could say something cheery, except it's cheery. You're still on the air. Nobody's come for you yet with a pike, right?
So far, not. But my cards have been marked long ago, and when the collapse unfolds, I think they'll be. One of the people that they would come and not trust would be me, because I go on and on about these issues all the time.
Well, I'm delighted you are going on about them. As you may be able to tell, my voice is about to disappear. How are we doing for time?
Yep, another 10 minutes.
Okay.
You got that in you?
you just have to listen to me gawk a little bit, that's all.
You talked about that new paper that referred to the fact that people are spending so much time indoors and under artificial lights. But another aspect that came out of that paper was that they are also inhaling toxic fumes. And in the book, there's a section on toxins as influences. In our homes, we sit on all of these synthetic couches. We have synthetic floorboards, we have synthetic floor coverings.
We're all inhaling
a whole lot of chemicals and particles from all of that synthetics.
Yeah, for instance, formaldehyde is everywhere, and it's one of the things that people are allergic to. And as you may recall, one of the things in Jaws is if the kids have stuffy noses for the first few years of their lives, their jaw development goes to hell. And they end up, among other things, with sleep apnea, stress, and cancer. But we still load our homes with all of moving indoors. The way we did it was in some ways a big mistake. In other ways, of course, putting screens on windows and separating ourselves from the mosquitoes was not a mistake, except to the degree that it let our population get so large. But, the whole toxic situation, every time you get one of those printed out receipts from a cash register, you're getting bisphenol A absorbed into your system. We've all got it. It's everywhere on the planet. There's a lot of evidence that it's not good for you. So, but try and stop it. The these synthetic chemicals that are not carefully checked. I've always advised my students, for example, when they ask me, what can you do about toxic chemicals? One thing you can do is don't use spray cans of any kind. Don't use spray underarm deodorant, aerosols, and so on. We don't even know from decent testing whether the petroleum distillate that's often the carrier of these chemicals is good for you if you inhale it. In other words, the less contact you can have, particularly by breathing in or eating a lot of these chemicals, the better off you're going to be, because a lot of them are never really tested. They're put on a list called the GRAS list, the generally recognized as safe, G-R-A-S. And what that means is we haven't seen a lot of people dropping dead right after they use their underarm deodorant. But when they get, if they should say get cancer 25 years later, the cancer doesn't print out. This is due to a mutation you originally got from chemical XYZ that was in your underarm deodorant, or was in your frying pan stuff, or was in the receipts you got at the store. Unhappily, a lot of the problems we get where we don't understand the source are undoubtedly, in my view, connected with exposure to chemicals that screw up your DNA. Lots and lots of things screw up DNA. Lots of plant chemicals, lots of natural things do. We don't understand it as thoroughly as we ought to. End of lecture. End of sermon.
One of the reasons why I don't have children is when I was an adolescent working in the Waikato in New Zealand, I used to spray weeds for the neighboring farms around where we live. And I used to spray paraquat. You can't buy paraquat anymore because they finally had to admit how bad it was. And
No, I was just going to say, I think I saw something recently that Parkinson's is tied maybe to paraquat, but there's several very commonly used pesticides that they hadn't identified for sure. But Parkinson's, of course, is very common. It may be partly more diagnosed, but it also looks like it's tied to an exposure to another one of these toxic chemicals. And if you've had any friends with Parkinson's, you know what a misery it is.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely heartbreaking to see people falling apart with those kinds of ailments. Yeah, when I used to do that spraying, I would often be doing it in just a pair of rugby shorts and a hat, virtually no clothes on. And the spray would blow back over me, when I was spraying up into the wind by mistake. And I can always remember thinking, oh, it's so refreshing.
Oh, my God.
But, we had no proper training. All those chemicals came out into the community, and there was no real training on how to deal with them.
Oh, sure. They used to just – I can remember when Ann and I – this would have been 1955, roughly – when we were graduate students at the University of Kansas, and we go to a thing called a drive-in theater. I think they're extinct in the United States now, or very nearly. Are there any left in New Zealand? Remember
no.
Drive-ins?
Yeah, anyway, I do remember them, but no, none here.
We'd be sitting there watching the movie, and somebody would pull a trailer up next to our car, and a blower with a mouth on it about a foot and a half wide would blast DDT into our car and us. That was the way they kept the mosquitoes down. And that was common in the 40s and 50s, that they just sprayed it everywhere. Didn't matter. It was harmless because, of course, they tested it by giving somebody a spoonful of DDT. And you could eat a spoonful of DDT without dropping dead. But the issue, of course, was not just the effect of immediate poisoning through your gut. And now if you look at people's blood around the world, the results read like the shelf list of an organic chemistry lab. And most of the things we're loaded with, they have no real idea what the results are, because they can't run the kind of experiments ethically that you'd have to run to figure it out. You got to depend on testing on things like mice, and the tests are not often enough done and not often all that done that well. So anything else I can say to cheer you up?
I saw when I was in Belize in the mid-1980s, and in the early evening, a truck used to drive around Belize City, and or not one, lots of them, and they would just spray this insecticide.
Yeah.
It was probably DDT.
And well, same thing happened in Kansas.
Coming out of the truck.
We had a massive aerial spraying here for a pest called the Mediterranean fruit fly that was totally unnecessary. But people don't understand the sort of longer term threats. You know, it's very hard for all of us to think long term, because for most of our evolutionary history, there was no point in thinking long term. In other words, if you evolved to watch to catch movement against a sort of steady environmental background, you had to detect if a leopard was jumping at you as fast as you could, and we still automatically get out of the way of cars and so on with that mechanism. But if the climate was going to change on Australopithecus, there was nothing for you to detect, and there's nothing you could do about it if you did detect it. So we've moved from a situation where our senses evolved to catch basically motion against the stationary background to detecting changes in the background. The gradual accumulation of nuclear weapons, the gradual accumulation of poisons, the gradual growth of the population. And it's very hard for us to register on those potentially very lethal gradual changes in our environment. We're much better at ducking a baseball thrown at our head than in dealing with a bisphenol charged receipt from a cash register.
Look, I see this all the time. One of the things that why I so love this little island that we're on, there's no grid-tied electricity and there's no reticulated water. So everyone has to make their own electricity and catch their own water off the roof. And what I see is that our children, and I refer to every one of those children on the island as our children, they are much more feral and they're much more adaptive. And this is the problem that we have with urbanization, where so many children are growing up in an urban environment and all the electricity and water appears to be infinite, and they don't have any concept about how important these things are.
And where it comes from. At least if it comes off the roof, your kids know where the water comes from. Have you found any way to keep them from being on cell phones all the time, or is the electricity not enough to keep the cell phones going?
Oh, that's
or computer games.
That's a very interesting subject. I had a dear mate, Greg Rogers, come back from Gibraltar with his family, and he came out here, and he failed to tell his young girls, that there was no internet connection. And if you should have seen the meltdown that took place when they found out that they couldn't get online. And it's just a microcosm of how dependent we have become to the internet. And it's distracting everybody.
My friends with teenage kids say it's essentially an addiction. One of the biggest problems, they're all aware of these problems, but it is just hell to try and wean the kids away. It's a major, major problem, but none of my friends at least seems to have a good solution to it. We all do need a new cell phone every 6 months to keep the economy growing. You will admit that.
Yes, it's a nightmare. Yeah. It's just another one of the nightmares. And one of the things that I always think about is that, you know, when I talk with you and Guy McPherson and people who have been in this game for a long time, we know that the situation is really dire, but we only know a part of the story. It can only be, you know, people think you and I are real doomers and we're always talking about how dire the situation is, but you and I don't know the half of it.
Oh, talk to somebody in the water business, a geologist, so on. They'll really depress you. Well, I'm going to have to quit.
Yeah, no, our time is up, Paul. Look, I'm absolutely very, very grateful for your time. And I have enormous respect for the work that you and Anne have done over the years. And I'd like to thank you very much. And I think we'll, on that note, we'll hand over to the studio.
Thank you for the coverage. And let's do it again one of these days. Just get everybody to buy Jaws. Take care.
Thank you very much, Paul. Talk to you soon, brother.
Gonna get you, you betcha.